You won't be impressed. One of them dates 1931.
Oh, what have we got coming up here? Don't we have an assignment coming up?
Next week.
Next week? Why don't we collect this thing in about 3 weeks?
Do we have any more tests in here?
Oh, we have all kinds of tests. Assignments, tests.
Unannounced or announced?
You got it. Every possible learning aid that you can think of will pull out of the hat. Sign the rule book twice tonight, and your test and assignment are also here. You can pull them out. File 13 is an explanation of Greek texts. Now, Metzger in his book has a chapter on this, and so do several of the other Greek textual critic books on textual criticism. And there's information in there that's probably on this test. I don't know where I got all this information, but this test is pretty thorough. Maybe we'll go over some of it tonight. Besides there being an apparatus of manuscripts, there's also an apparatus of texts. Now, since we've just defined what a text is, Erasmus made the first Greek text in 1516. That's known as Erasmus. It's number one on the thing here. And number two is the Complutensian Polyglot. It was published in 1520. Stephanus is the third one. In 1550 he began and published, I think it was four editions. Then Beza, he put out a whole string of editions. I think he put out nine of them. And so if you'll wander through this handout, you'll find textual critics. Number 16 is good old Tischendorf. Then we come down to 18, Westcott and Hort. And the last one, 27, is UBS. There are a few I've omitted on this handout, but these are the main texts put out by important and famous textual critics down through the ages. Now, these texts differ based on the principles that the critic used to make the text and also the material that he had to make it from. Do you have a question there?
Is this included in that in the pastor gave in a sermon about the manuscript of the translation?
Some of that information may be on here. Oh, okay.
We're dealing with translations.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember myself. These Greek texts basically give an overview of the history of textual criticism. Really, the most important thing is UBS, what we have today. But it is of some interest to note what's gone on in the past. Erasmus operating in the 1500s. Then there were men in the 1600s, men in the 1700s, men in the 1800s, and of course in the 1900s, a few things have been done. Not a lot is being done in the field right now, other than UBS, maybe put out a fourth edition or whatever. The field has been pretty much combed. There are some areas that could be looked into more, maybe study of ancient versions or something like that. But in the whole, unless they get a lot of new manuscript discoveries, there probably won't be much new Greek text put out. Now, of course, there are differences of opinion as to what school of thought you hold to, and that'll always produce some new text. But as far as UBS goes, I don't know that they're going to put out much more. They may put out a fourth edition, but maybe they feel like they can improve on their third edition. So unless there's something to work with and a reason to change, there isn't going to be much done. There's also an apparatus of texts. And that's interesting. That's found in Englishman's Greek New Testament. In Englishman's Greek New Testament, they give an apparatus. The apparatus is of texts. It's not of manuscripts. You won't find B and Aleph there. You'll find Erasmus, Westcott and Hort, Locke, Wintergellis. You find these different guys and what they read in their text. Now, the interest that is that if you decide to choose, let's say, Luke 22, which we have already studied, I argued that it was in. Some of you argued that it was out. We could glance at Englishman's Greek New Testament, and we can get a list of all the other scholars that think it's in and those that think it's out. And that's interesting. Find out who else agrees with you, and then you could fire them at your opponents instead of yourself. It's always good to be able to quote somebody else in the field rather than yourself. If I was going to argue for Luke 22, I'd probably quote one of those scholars who feels it's in, or else I'd quote Linsky. I can hide behind Linsky. He has a bigger shield than I do. Carries more clout in the scholarly field. Let me give you abbreviations for these texts. I'm sure you'll catch on to the pattern. Rasmus is capital E, small r. You could just write this right on file 13. Capital E, small r. Complutensian is C. Stephanus is S. These are capital S now. Bezes, capital B. Elzevir is E. The next one of important is number 11. Griesbach is G.
These are all capitals?
Yes, all capitals. Lachman is L. You might ask, how do you distinguish those from unsealed manuscripts? They're always found in the same list. They're never mixed together. So it's obvious by looking at the list, you know immediately that you would be dealing with textual critics and not manuscripts, and so there wouldn't be any confusion. Trigelles is capital T, small r, number 14. Alford is A. Tischendorf is T. Wordsworth is W. Westcott and Hort is WH.
Okay.
Yes. Number 19 and number 22 are both abbreviated R. That stands for revisers. Palmer and Soder reconstructed the Greek text used for the ERV in 1881, so it's designated R. Nestle is N. Number 21 is N. 24, 25, and 26 are all given the designation capital R, small o. Capital R, small o. This stands for Roman Catholic text. These are more modern Roman Catholic texts. 27 is UBS. Let me talk about number 1, 3, 4, and 5.
These are all called the Textus Receptus. These are all equal to Textus Receptus is capital T, capital R. Now, this gets to be a little bit confusing, but these are so similar to one another that they are just referred to in the loose sense as the TR, the Textus Receptus, which is Latin for just received text. That's all that means. Text. Now, I said Englishman's Greek New Testament in the library was the King James text. That is this. Englishman's Greek New Testament This is a Greek interlinear of the King James text, and it's the one that has this textual apparatus in the footnotes. It's a New Testament interlinear over there in the Greek section. It is the 1550 edition of Stephanus. It's also called the TR, or Textus Receptus,
because it is. There's so little changes, they're practically identical. Now, some additional history to file 13. By the way, the Textus Receptus pretty much dominated the field of textual criticism up to the mid and late 1700s. It reigned from 1516 to approximately 1750 to 1770. From 1770 to 1830, there's a transition where there were those scholars who wanted to break away from the Textus Receptus and choose an uncialed text rather than a minuscule text.
Now, the Textus Receptus is called a minuscule text. And the reason it's called that is because it's based on manuscripts 10th century and later. So it's a minuscule text.
It's based on minuscule manuscripts. In fact, Erasmus had no manuscript earlier than the 10th century when he made his first text in 1516. So we call the Textus Receptus a minuscule text, not because it has anything to do with minuscule handwriting or anything to do with that. It's just because it's based on minuscule manuscripts. Go ahead.
Okay, Erasmus is 1516. The King James is 1611. Remember, manuscript Aleph wasn't even discovered until, what was it, 1859 or something? So we're way up in a whole other century before we even get into the main uncial manuscripts.
Manuscript A, I think it made its way to England in 1627, missed the King James. It was an early one. Manuscript D was owned by Beza. It's named after him. But they didn't use Manuscript D because they didn't trust it. Besides that, it only had the Gospels and Acts. So, the Textus Receptus is considered to be a minuscule text. Scholars, by 1770 to 1830, had a whole list of uncial manuscripts. It was obvious to them that the Textus Receptus was not accurate in a number of places. But the attempts to change it were regarded as sacrilege, and so to convert to an uncial text was very difficult. Then from 1830 to the present has been the restoration of the original text. Restoration of the original text. Tradition dies hard. It's hard to get people to change. Now, what is the origin of the TR? Gutenberg's printing press was invented about 1450 to 56. The first Bible printed was a Latin Bible, and it's called the Gutenberg Bible. There's nothing special about the Gutenberg Bible. It's just a Latin translation that was the first Bible printed, and it's called Gutenberg after the man who invented the press. For the next 50 years, over 100 editions of the Latin Bible were printed. By 1550, the Bible was printed in Czechoslovakian, French, German, and Italian. Parts of the Greek New Testament were printed in 1481. Of course, Erasmus was the first one to print a Greek New Testament complete in 1516. And by the way, Tyndale's first translation was in 1525. So he was right on top of Erasmus and used Erasmus's Greek text for his translation. And the King James Bible is 70% Tyndale. So you can see the King James is really locked into this era. And the King James really isn't that bad. It's not like we're way off in left field somewhere. In fact, the main need for an update in the King James, not the Greek text, is the translation itself. It's the English part of it. Now, Erasmus was the most famous Greek scholar of his day. It's kind of interesting how this got to be. The Turks invaded Constantinople in the 1400s. I don't have the date exactly. I might have it down here somewhere. I don't have it. It's in the 1400s. And the language of Constantinople was Greek, because it's, you know, in Greece. And Greeks fled Constantinople all across Europe, fleeing the Turks. And they brought their Greek language and their Greek books. And oddly enough, learning Greek came to be a fad in Europe. It was a fad to learn Greek. It was in vogue. And Erasmus was a famous Greek teacher. And a publisher named Froben learned the Catholics were about ready to publish a Greek New Testament. In fact, it was already finished. And all the Catholics were waiting for was the Pope's okay and stamp of approval. And they'd print this thing, and this publisher named Froben, he recognized that to be the first on the market would be a real moneymaker. So he really had only monetary interest in this whole thing. So he contacted Erasmus and said, "Give me a Greek New Testament that I can print." Erasmus went to Basel and hoped to find a Greek manuscript to send to the printer. He had no intention of doing any textual criticism work. He just hoped to find a Greek manuscript. There are lots of manuscripts. They just weren't known where they were. So he went to Basel, to the library there, and to his dismay, none of the manuscripts were complete, and they even had to be corrected and edited before they could be sent to the printer. And so, without wanting to, Erasmus became the first textual critic to actually put together a New Testament, all in Greek. He had to go through these manuscripts, and he had two main manuscripts, none of them complete. He had one of the Gospels, one of the Acts and the Epistles. These are 12th century. He had two or three others comparing these with, and he didn't even have a complete book of Revelation. So the last six verses he borrowed from the Latin and translated them back into Greek, from which we have in the book of Revelation a reading, the book of life. I believe it's in chapter 22, verse something. It's in no known Greek manuscript. It only comes from the Latin Vulgate. But it found its way into the King James along with the rest of the stuff. Erasmus published, put out a 1,000-page volume of the Greek New Testament. It was a literary sensation, a big success. It captured all the initial sales. And since Greek was in vogue, and many people actually knew Greek, who ordinarily wouldn't have, the book actually sold to people, and people began reading the New Testament in Greek. Of course, this isn't going to be too popular with the Catholics. People start understanding what the New Testament says. Now, Erasmus also put a Latin translation opposite the Greek. And in this, he differed from the Vulgate, which made it unpopular. And he put footnotes in his New Testament in which he cut down the clergy for their sins. That went over like a lead balloon. At Oxford and Cambridge, students were forbidden to read Erasmus. In his second edition in 1519, his third edition in 1522, he added 1 John 5:7. You know the story. His fourth edition in 1527, he corrected it from the Complutensian. The Complutensian finally came out in 1522. By that time, people had already bought Erasmus. And so he used the Complutensian to correct his fourth edition, 1527. He also corrected 90 passages in Revelation. He put out a fifth edition in 1535, which is little different than the rest. Now, Metzger says, subsequent editors, though making a number of alterations in Erasmus's text, essentially reproduced this debased form of the Greek New Testament. Having secured an undeserved preeminence, what came to be called the TR of the New Testament resisted for 400 years all scholarly efforts to replace it in favor of an earlier and more accurate text, mostly superstition and tradition. Then comes Stephanus. Stephanus was a Parisian printer and publisher. He had Erasmus's works plus seven other manuscripts. And he published four editions of the Greek New Testament. In his fourth edition, he numbered the verses. This is the first time the New Testament had verse numbers in it. He also included a primitive critical apparatus. Following him, Theodore Beza, and following him, the Elzevir brothers, good old Abraham and Bonaventure. Now, the Elzevir brothers basically were reprinting Beza. Beza's text differs little from Stephanus. These texts are all very similar. Now, in the Elzevir brothers' preface to their second edition in 1633, they said, quote, "The reader has the text which is now received by all, in which we give nothing changed or corrupted," unquote. Now, from that blurb, "the reader now has the text received by all," came the expression textus receptus. So they originated the phrase TR by that blurb in 1633. So the TR then is basically any one of these texts or all of them, but they're all basically the same. This then is the basis of the King James Version and almost all translations prior to 1881. Go ahead. Oh, this right here? This is modern Greek.
Modern Greek.
We're not talking about minuscule or uncial here. Modern Greek.
How did that develop?
Modern Greek?
Was that just like a better way to do it than a minuscule?
Same way English developed today. Today we have printing that comes off of a typewriter. It differs from books in the 1700s and 1600s. I have some books from the 1700s and 1600s. They're a little bit hard to read. The F's look like S's. There are a number of other little peculiarities. Mainly the spelling is real erratic. In fact, you might not even be able to read an original King James. You'd have to read it slowly because the letters are... they're formed differently than the way we would today. We're not used to it. Well, so Greek has evolved over the centuries, and this is just basic modern Greek. In fact, this is right off a typewriter. You can get Greek, one of those little balls for your IBM, as they call it. You can type modern Greek, just no problem. I'm sure we have one around here. Go ahead. Oh, UBS. UBS, without a doubt. Westcott and Hort is right up there with it. And it's kind of an argument back and forth, but I think UBS is superior.
Do they have an English translation of the Greek?
Interlinear? Well, the UBS and Westcott and Hort are so close together that the Westcott and Hart interlinear would serve as an interlinear for this 99% of the time. And in any place where it differed, I'm sure you could just get out your Greek dictionary and look it up. So, but I'm sure you're going to find them, two peas in a pod.
Do they
have one in UBS interlinear? No. But that purple interlinear, you can't beat that thing. Whatever they charge for that thing nowadays, it's practically identical to UBS. And the only place UBS is going to differ is going to be a variant reading. And a lot of those variants will have studied. So you pretty much have it. Westcott and Hort basically spent 30 years developing the principles of modern textual criticism. They capitalized on about 300 years of study done by other men and advanced it to a high degree of accuracy. They really refined Rule 5, put the finishing touches on that, and spent 28 years on this thing, so... Oh, yeah, 1881, we had all that. The only thing they didn't have was Beatty and Dodmer. And so UBS is giving us a reflection of Westcott and Hort plus Beatty and Dodmer and maybe some reflections on 50 years since then, 80 years since then, as far as just reflection on the textual principles that Westcott and Hort used. And UBS being a committee, there's a certain amount of balance in the committee. So I think the UBS is the top of the field. I don't think it could be improved on, really, unless we had more manuscripts to work from. And, of course, the only way I'd improve it is I'd put my own opinions in at certain places, like in Luke 22. But, you know, I'm going by. There's other times where I'll disagree with them. But, you know, there are certain reasons for that. And perhaps Mark 16, the 20 are working on that. Let's do next week. Is that correct? And you might disagree with them on that one. And if so, of course, that would be. But that's a matter of... matter of opinion there. As far as the text itself goes, I think it's the best that they could put out.
You know what, the NAS, is it pretty much
an NAS is based on Nestle, and Nestle began back at the turn of the century and has gone through some 25 editions. Nestle's text is a collation of texts. So, Nestle is not collating manuscripts. Nestle is collating right here. Translation works like UBS? Yeah, good news from Modern Man. It's obvious that the translation, as far as good news goes, good news could have come from the correct receptus and produced the same thing. See, there's a big deal between the Greek and the English. It really depends on the purpose that the person has in making his English translation. The good news from Modern Man's purpose was to translate the Bible into
I start out with English that would be readable by people of low education and people who wrote English as a second language. So, and to be used in the mission. That's a whole new purpose then, let's say an Ampliform word or a numerical standard. Numerical standard is translated for our Christians, to get the most literal and accurate translation we can get. So that's a whole different purpose. Coming from NASA, coming from UBS, NASA is probably going to change it, maybe follow it. It just isn't a whole lot of difference. Besides that, everybody has different mass lives in a few places. Yeah, the 26th edition. But we don't know the everybody has used the 26th edition. Or no, they didn't. Because the 26th edition.
Some of these men, just looking at them, John Mill, his contribution to textual criticism was compiling lists of various readings. He found over 30,000 variants in the New Testament. Bengel's contribution was in advancing textual principles. Bengel advanced textual principles. Bengel himself published essentially the TR. He said, "I could not publish a text of my own, neither the publisher nor the public would have stood for it." He did alter Revelation in 19 passages, and so many railed at that, that he had to publish a defense of the New Testament. Bengel said by some to be the father of modern textual criticism. Wettstein visited libraries all over Europe. He was charged with unorthodoxy of beliefs and being an Arian because he chose hos instead of theos in 1 Timothy 3:16 because of manuscript A. He was dismissed from his post and had to flee to Holland. Wettstein is the author of Manuscript Notation, letter codes for the uncials and an Arabic number for the minuscules. Griesbach, he is another man that carried on the work of Bengel. He founded new theories in textual criticism. Until his day, among nearly 360 editions of the New Testament, there are basically two forms of the text, the TR and the Complutensian. The Complutensian circulating among the Catholics, the TR, of course, among the Protestants. Griesbach divided the manuscripts into three classes, which he called families: Alexandrian, Western, and Byzantine. In other words, he started developing text types. He chose the readings supported by the most families and favored the Alexandrian family. So even at that early time, he began to sense this principle. He omitted 1 John 5:7, and for which he was long and severely attacked. He was accused of corrupting the sacred scriptures. Lachmann is an interesting fellow. Lachmann was not a theologian. He was a classicist. He had done textual critical work in the classics and turned to the New Testament and treated it like a piece of classical literature, put out a text, didn't think anything about it. This caused a storm of criticism. Instead of revering the TR, He just went by the oldest manuscripts and threw the TR basically out the window. He was, as it were, not a theologian, and he was outside of the theological bias and basically ignorant of all the prejudice that was involved. He issued his New Testament without even so much as an introduction. What he basically did was serve as a lightning rod for a lot of criticism, and then scholars that came after him could go ahead with the New Testament while he took all the brunt of accusation. Lachmann was really the death knell of the TR. After Lachmann, fear and respect for the TR among scholars went downhill quickly because Lachmann broke the ice, basically abandoned it totally, and started all over. And this really helped scholars in the future. Lachmann was shocked at the criticism. He couldn't understand why. But he wasn't in religious circles and didn't understand the religious prejudice. It's like a secular scholar translating the New Testament, paying no heed to the King James. In our day, that isn't so much of a, doesn't make so many waves. But 100 years ago, you'd be blasted severely for deviating from the King James. In fact, a lot of translations reflect a lot of the King James. While they're trying to change things, they're still doing a lot of homage to the King James. Tregelles is perhaps the most spiritual of all the texture critics. While Tischendorf traveled far and wide, supported by various governments and given fame and acclaim, Tregelles faced poverty, opposition, and ill health. He's a contemporary of Tischendorf, born 2 years earlier, died 1 year later. He's a Quaker of origin, and later was associated with the Plymouth Brethren. He's no doubt the most spiritual of all scholars in the field. He's not a liberal in any sense. In fact, he refuted the liberals. And he's a man to be reckoned with in these areas. He advanced the theories and principles of textual criticism further than any of his predecessors. His text was published prior to manuscript Aleph and B, and therefore is inferior to the later ones. But his work in textual principles is, of course, very valuable. Tischendorf is credited with discovering 18 enseals and 6 minuscules. And at that period of history, that was quite an accomplishment. Then somebody that isn't on the chart, who you probably want to write down some notes on. Frederick Henry Ambrose Scrivener. Scrivener.
See if I get this spelled right. There you go.
Scrivener. Scrivener was a teacher and a clergyman. He published the Textus Receptus. And, boy, I don't have a date down here, but we're talking about the late 19th century. He published the Textus Receptus with readings from Elzevir, Lachmann, Tischendorf, Tregelles. He wrote a great big fat work on textual criticism. Scrivener was a teacher and a clergyman, and he leaned back towards the Textus Receptus at a time when most all critics were leaning real far away from it. Now, my feeling is this, and this is probably heresy for Metzger if I were to say this, and he would be here, but just kind of knowing what I know and knowing the way things go,
here's the middle of the road, and here's the TR. And we've been going this way for a long time, and finally we break away from the TR, and my opinion is we've gone somewhere over here. I think we're over here today. I think that UBS is a state-of-the-art text, but I think that for some reason they have an aversion to the TR more so than necessary. I think they've swung across the road over to here. My feeling is that the TR is right in some places. For example, Luke 22. There are some other places where I think the TR is right. I don't care what Alf and Dee and Metzger and all those guys say. I think they're down here somewhere. Maybe not this far. Maybe they're about right here. There's a tendency when you get out of one ditch to cross over the middle of the road and get a little bit on the other side of the road. Maybe not all the way to the other ditch. But there have been recent studies in the 40s and 50s that have recognized that the TR isn't as bad as they thought, and that there's some arguments for some of the readings there. And Scribner, what basically Scribner was a reverting back towards the TR at a time when everybody was charging away from it. And I have a lot of respect for Scribner, although I'm not as conservative to the TR as he is. I think he's, you know, bound by certain things that I'm not bound by. Bernard Weiss. Here's some interesting information about Weiss. Do you have Weiss on your hand out there? He was a commentator and tend to be more subjective. By subjective, we would probably say he leaned more on internal evidence than external evidence. He grouped the variants under headings. Heading number one, harmonization among the Gospels. In other words, he listed a whole bunch of variants which were harmonizations among the Gospels. Number two, interchange of words. There are a lot of variants that amount to nothing more than interchange of words. Then there's number three, omissions and additions. We've looked at a number of those ourselves. Omissions and additions. Number four, alterations of order. Alterations of order. Number five, orthographical, which is spelling. Orthographical variations. Now, what he did was, he went over a number of statistics, and in one separate study, he found manuscript A correct one time alone. Manuscript Aleph correct three times alone. And manuscript B correct 85 times alone. It's kind of an interesting study. In other words, he took the variants, made a decision as to what was accurate, in a place where he felt an A type of variant, A rating. He felt very confident in his choice. And then he went and rated the manuscripts as to their accuracy. That's kind of an interesting thing to do. Well, A was right only one time alone now. Aleph three times alone, and B was 85 times. They give B a high rating, manuscript B. And Weiss did rely on Westcott and Hort and manuscript B extensively. Another textual critic who is very famous, J.W. Burgon, B-U-R-G-O-N. He's not on your paper, but you might want to write down a note about him. B-U-R-G-O-N. Burgon played devil's advocate. He argued vehemently for the King James text.
He's the author of the book in the library, The Last 12 Verses of Mark, 400 pages. He argues for the accuracy of the received text. Now, a lot of what he says is based on the idea that, well, the church can't be wrong. It's been the text of the church for 400 years. That argument doesn't get anywhere with me. But some of his arguments are pretty good. So that's why I probably put myself... I probably lean back to the TR, at least in some places where UBS doesn't. Bergen, I know Bergen can't be right in what he says. He's too extreme. But he does say some good things every now and then. He argues that the TR is superior to Westcott and Hort because of its universal acceptance by the church. And the church is the divine institution. And this is conclusive proof of its authenticity. Of course, this is the same argument the Catholics use to vindicate them as the real church. Now, what Bergen did was he really aided textual criticism a lot. He did extensive manuscript study among the cursives. He also made a vast index of quotations from the fathers. Of course, all of this trying to prove certain points, but all of this wealth of information that he gathered together was used by later textual critics. So Bergen is a vehement advocate of the Textus Receptus. But he is a respected textual critic. There are some vehement advocates of the Textus Receptus who I consider nothing more than crackpots. Then Caspar René Gregory, or just C.R. Gregory. C.R. Gregory, 1846 to 1917. Gregory studied under Tischendorf. Gregory also published a Greek New Testament at the turn of the 1900s. And he listed uncials to 0165. He listed papyri to P14. He listed minuscules to 2304. And Gregory's manuscript notation system, which was borrowed from Wettstein and improved, is now used today. Olland continues this manuscript list begun by Gregory. In 1963, Olland listed papyri manuscripts to P76. He listed uncial manuscripts to 0250. And he listed minuscules to 2646. In 1967, he listed papyri to P78. And in 1969, reported there were 300 additions to the above list. And I don't have a current list, but Olland keeps the list running. And of course, should there be any significant discoveries, it would undoubtedly make headlines and we would learn about it and may even prompt a new edition of the text or whatever. But anything significant that would come out, we would learn about through archaeological magazines and so forth. And the critics would all write on it, study it, and add it to our field of knowledge. I don't think there's been anything significant since really Bodmer and Beatty. But there have been little things here and there. Let me see if I have anything more. Which are the best texts? Well, I rate the text about like this. UBS and Westcott and Hort I put as number one. After them, Nestle. And then Tischendorf and the Revisers. I put the Revisers somewhere around Tischendorf. Not as good as Nestle. After Tischendorf, Tregelles, then Alford, then Lachmann, then Griesbach. After Griesbach, I put all the rest, which are basically the TR. I put them all kind of in one little big batch. I don't know if we could really make that many distinctions between them. Of course, Stephanus would be better than Erasmus, Beza better than Stephanus, but just minor changes there. What about the Roman Catholic text? Well, the Roman Catholic text is rated down by Griesbach, by critics. Why is that? Because the Roman Catholics go on different textual critical principles than we do. They have a very high reverence for the Latin Vulgate, which prejudices them in certain readings, and consequently their text isn't given as much respect. So they tend to take Latin Vulgate readings over Aleph and A and B and so forth, and so the Roman text isn't given a very high rating. Now on this test I have which is the best text, and then I give you, you know, T, R, L, T, and N, and of course you know what those stand for, and circle the right answer. Well, Complutensian is so old that it would have to be the worse of the two. 1522. Obviously, they've made some advances since then. Okay, those are English translations. Those aren't Greek texts. But we'll be studying those here later. Go ahead.
I'm assuming these are all in order, all the texts in chronological order?
They are in basic chronological order on file 13, yes.
Okay, are they...
They're not in the order of their importance. Okay. Because Wordsworth went back to the TR in a lot of places and isn't considered as good as the others. Although I consider Wordsworth, I agree with him a lot of times.
Does this state anywhere where the significant manuscript discoveries were?
No. You pretty much have to know that and kind of overlap it with these dates of these critics. By the way, the contribution that these critics made to the field of textual criticism isn't always their text. Griesbach and Bengel, it was in Advancing Critical Principles and Trigelis. Westcott and Hort, it was their text. And UBS, of course, I would say their advancement is both the apparatus and the text. Their apparatus is maybe more valuable to us than their text. In fact, I'm sure it is. I think they would lean more on internal considerations from time to time and less on external ones. So let's say Luke 22, as it were, great drops of blood. There's no doubt, if I wasn't a theologian, or maybe I'm not a theologian, let's put it this way, if I wasn't spiritually attached to the reading, I would tend to maybe omit it based on manuscript evidence. But internal considerations affect me heavily in that place. And I give that more weight than Aleph and B or whatever the manuscript authority was there. Can't remember now. But so it affects you. But what we want to learn is we want to learn who they are, what their place is, you know, how what the principles they go by, so that we could evaluate. And if we do disagree with them, at least have an intelligent reason for disagreeing. And not just some prejudicial reason because we are married to the King James. Why do we choose it? See, if I choose Luke 22 and Metzger doesn't, at least I could argue for it. I don't really want to argue that much about it, but at least in my own mind, I'm not just going by the King James. I'm going by some real principles that I feel like I can use to make a decision. And I can evaluate the principles they use for their decision and see what weight I want to put on them. So That's basically what we want to do in this class. Now, let me give you a final comment. I've gotten through the textual information that I need to cover. I don't really want to spend any more time on it than that. How important is file 16 and file 13? It's somewhat important because you do kind of need a bigger field scope here for your information. First of all, today there's a huge controversy over the King James, the TR, etc. And so a little bit of knowledge on file 13 and file 16 is going to give you background for evaluating the validity of the claims made by the TR side and the Westcott and Hort side. And we'll be covering that later in depth, that controversy. But as far as practical application goes, I want you to learn how to use the apparatus, because that's where you're going to study variance. That's the meat of our class, the most important part. We do live in a world today where there's a lot of controversy in the church over certain issues, and this is one controversy that's going to be there. So I want you to at least have a rudimentary knowledge of it, and that's what I've attempted to do on file 16 and 13. File 16, take-home test. The field is wide open. You may ask anybody for help on this test. However, I want you to do your own work. I don't want you to borrow answers. Now, what do you mean, don't borrow answers? Don't just copy answers from somebody else's paper. However, if you need help on how to get the answer on any one of these, you can go to anybody you want for help. But I don't want you to just copy somebody's answers. And by the way, if you've dug out the answers, send somebody to the books you dug them out. Don't just give them your freebie answers. Make them do a little work. You'll learn something in the process. That's the name of the game, is learning. So I want you to learn something. I'm not intending this to be a 52-hour assignment. I am going to letter grade this. You could all get 100 on it. A lot of the answers are in the notes and in file 13. And you should be able to, well, you should be able to whip through this thing, I think. I've given you most of the notes, so. If you have any problems with it, you can ask me in future classes. The final test does not contain any information on file 13 and 16. I don't consider this the main part of our class. So file 16 is the only test you'll have on it in this class. And when we're done with this, we're done with it. That's it. It overlaps in a few other studies that we'll do. We'll kind of dig back into this and make some comments on it. But as far as testing goes, this is it. The final test is exclusively over file 6, 7, and 8, which we've had, and other related material in that same category. By now you can expect anything. And I think I've covered everything in class on that, on the final test. Pretty much. Real close. No, the end of this semester. It isn't necessarily the last test, it's just the most weighty test. And I don't want to wait till the end of the semester to have it. I'd like to have it at the end of November. Go ahead. No, this file 16, I said 3 weeks. So next week we'll work on Mark 16. We have an assignment there. You can be putting this off and dealing with it here after the homework next week. Well, I mainly want you to look into it for your own satisfaction. It isn't the length of the assignment. I'm not letter grading those assignments. So I mainly want you to be satisfied as to whether you think Tongues on Trial is biased and unreasonable in including it, or whether you think Metzger is biased and unreasonable for excluding it, or whether you just don't know and you're flipping a coin. I just want you to have your own opinion.
Are there libraries in the area that might have more extensive material on things we're covering than like some university libraries?
I doubt it. However, if there would be a library, it would be SPU, Seattle U, Those would be the two that I would guess. I've been to PLU. We have everything they've got. However, they did have some good books in there. I have since gotten those for our library. I photocopied one out of PLU and brought it up here. There's some others I just was able to garner through used book lists, but I don't know that you're going to find a whole lot that we don't have. We've pretty much got everything. There may be some recent books out that we haven't found out about. I usually keep up on that, but
as far as all these old moldy,
old and moldy stuff tends to be outdated in this field, so I don't think we're missing too much. The book I brought up was a book that had photographs of unseals, and that's always interesting no matter what date it is.
Is that the one in the
Hatch's book, yeah.
It looked pretty interesting to look at that day.
He wanted to know which libraries might have textual critical sections, and I said SPU or Seattle, you might. I've been to PLU and looked over what they had. They did have some good stuff, but I feel like we have as much or more. In fact, we have everything PLU has.
Have you ever considered this church and this, the library, everything about it, kind of as a, I've always looked at it as I've looked at the notes and the curriculum and all that.